The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for Mr. Stephen Flurry, who is, I believe, still in Austria. Now, this is one of those tragic days where I did have something completely different that I'd planned to speak to you about, but something big has come up that we have to address. I had planned to talk a bit more about Britain and also about the shrinking navy and about Brexit, and to follow on from what I spoke about on Thursday. And over the weekend, I did see one of the best articles I've ever seen on Brexit, and we will still get to that a bit later. But first, we have to talk about the shooting at the homosexual nightclub in Orlando, Florida. It's the biggest terrorist attack on American soil since 9/11. 50 people dead. And here's something you may not know if you confined your news watching to outlets like the BBC. The shooter was a Muslim. We had finished our Pentecost church services yesterday when I heard about the shooting, and I have the BBC's news app on my phone, which sends notifications when there's a breaking story. And so I'd seen that it had popped up on my phone that 50 people were dead in a mass shooting in America. And sadly, when you see mass shooting in America in a headline, it could be for a whole bunch of different reasons. But with so many dead, it sounded like a terrorist attack, so I read the BBC's article to find out what was going on. The trouble was, it didn't really tell you what was going on. I didn't see any mention of Islam or of the fact that the shooter was a Muslim in the whole article. To find out that this was an Islamist terrorist attack from this BBC article that they had up there initially, you had to read between the lines. You know, they did give you the guy's name, Omar Martin. Omar tends to be a Muslim name, at least all the people that I've known called Omar have been from the Middle East. Then a bit further down, the BBC quoted the guy's dad saying the attack had nothing to do with religion. So, of course, they don't mention the shooter's religion, but they do quote somebody saying that it's got his dad saying it's nothing to do with religion. So you knew that there had to be some kind of religious element there somewhere. Finally, somewhere fairly deep within the article, it also mentions that although the shooter was born in the US, he was of Afghan descent. So from this article, you had to really kind of it's almost like a forensic jigsaw puzzle to find out what was going on. A friend then suggested that I look over at Fox News. And that was much clearer. It's third paragraph in, he was born in New York to parents of Afghan origin and was a Muslim, Fox News confirmed. The BBC, they're meant to be the gold standard of news reporting. In the UK, if you have a TV, you have to pay the BBC about £140 a year. And they're meant to then kind of set the standard for clear, well-written news that gives you all the facts, that gives you the facts concisely and in uncontroversial topics. They're great. They asked one of the best websites for giving you all the essential facts in a short amount of time, concisely and well-written. But this time in this article, they really seem to go all the way out their way to avoid mentioning Islam, to avoid mentioning the word Muslim. And the whole article was kind of confusing and convoluted as they tried to do this. The Fox News piece was much clearer because they weren't tying themselves in knots to try and hide anything. And what Fox wrote, you know, he was born in New York to parents of Afghan origin and was a Muslim, Fox News confirmed. That is in no shape or form Islamophobic. If you just heard about the shooting like I had and wanted to know what was happening, that is a pertinent fact. That's an important fact. It's not opinion. It's not conjecture. It's a fact that is important to understanding what was happening. But the BBC, the supposed gold standard in reporting, tried to hide it. Now, that was just my initial encounter with this event, and they weren't the only ones trying to hide this fact. There were reports, for example, that Reddit subreddit on news, its main subreddit on news, was muting or blocking anyone who mentioned the fact that the shooter was a Muslim. Most of our listeners are probably not too familiar with Reddit, but it's It's a website for sharing news stories, sharing any website, basically. It aims to be the front page of the web. I use it a fair bit for gathering news stories. And the subreddit is a top source of news for a lot of people. I think the biggest demographic of Reddit users are generally tech-savvy young men. And for that demographic, their news subreddit is a very big source of news. And at least according to a few reports from a few different websites, they deemed any mention of the shooter's religion Islamophobic. And you weren't allowed to mention it or post news articles mentioning that in the title. Facebook, another big social media webpage, they responded to the attack by blocking and deleting a popular page that they seemed to think was extreme or extremist. And no, it wasn't a Islamist webpage or pro-terrorist webpage. Hopefully they're blocked already. And instead, in the aftermath of the attack, they banned a Facebook group called Stop Islamization of America. It's a Facebook group with over 50,000 people run by Pamela Geller, a critic of Islam who writes for Breitbart, a journalist. And Breitbart wrote, "The timing of this shutdown cannot be ignored. According to Geller, the group has been in operation for 6 years, since 2010. So this Facebook webpage has been around for 6 years, and in the aftermath of this shooting carried out by a Muslim, by a somewhat radical Muslim, they decide it's time to shut that website down. So Reddit, Facebook, and these are the giants of online discussion. Along with Twitter, they pretty much dominate talk on the internet. But if you want to talk about Islamic terrorism, you're not allowed. A few years ago, if you said Islam is a religion of violence, that was Islamophobic. And now all you need to do is mention the religion of the shooter, and you're an Islamophobe. That's it. But this goes far higher than the BBC or other news outlets or Reddit or Facebook. Here's a clip from it's the first minute and a half of the US President Barack Obama's speech after the attack.
Today, as Americans, we grieve the brutal murder, a horrific massacre of dozens of innocent people. We pray for their families who are grasping for answers with broken hearts. We stand with the people of Orlando who have endured a terrible attack on their city. Although it's still early in the investigation, we know enough to say that this was an act of terror and an act of hate. And as Americans, we are united in grief, in outrage, and in resolve to defend our people. I just finished a meeting with FBI Director Comey and my Homeland Security and National Security advisors. The FBI is on the scene and leading the investigation in partnership with local law enforcement. I've directed that the full resources of the federal government be made available for this investigation. We are still learning all the facts. This is an open investigation. We've reached no definitive judgment on the precise motivations of the killer. The FBI is appropriately investigating this as an act of terrorism, and I've directed that we must spare no effort to determine what, if any, inspiration or association this killer may have had with terrorist groups. What is clear is that he was a person filled with hatred. Over the coming days, we will uncover why and how this happened, and we will go wherever the facts lead us.
So we have no judgment on the motivations of the killer. We don't know all the facts. And Mr. Obama spoke for about 5 or 6 minutes, and in that whole speech, he didn't once mention Islam, Islamist, Islamic extremist, Islamist terrorist. He didn't mention Muslim, the word Muslim, Muslims at all. Not once. And this speech was given around 1:30 p.m. Eastern time. And there were a lot of facts that were already known at that point. Shortly before the speech, NBC had a report. They reported that the shooter had called the police and sworn allegiance to the Islamic State. I think that might give us a hint as to what his motivations are. Florida Senator Bill Nelson, he had said before this speech that the shooting appears to be connected to Islamic radicalism. So there was already plenty of evidence that this was an Islamist terrorist attack for anyone who was willing to look at the facts. Other officials had already said this was an Islamist attack. And Mr. Obama, he's the president. He would have access to more of this information and more of this information more quickly than anyone else. But he said he had no judgment on the motivations of the killer. And what's really shocking to me is we see the same script every time. Mr. Flurry talked about this on the program last time there was a terrorist attack. And you kind of think, okay, well, this time they'll wake up. Surely there's been another attack now, the biggest since 9/11. They'll have to admit there's a problem here. But they don't. They keep going, keep trying to pretend like everything is fine. This has nothing to do with Islam, nothing to do with Islamic extremism. In fact, we're not even going to tell you in our news reporting that the terrorist was a Muslim because you don't need to know that. That's not important. It has nothing to do with this attack. That's what some in the media seem to be saying about it. James Woolsey, he served as the director of the CIA under President Bill Clinton. So, hardly someone from the extreme right of American politics. So the CIA director under President Clinton said facts don't seem to matter to this administration in this matter. And he said, this reluctance is doing real damage. You can't effectively fight something if you can't discuss it. And that's absolutely right. And this isn't just the president. It's a wide-ranging problem. Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal, he said, the Senate's inaction on the common sense gun violence prevention makes it complicit in this public health crisis. That's what this is. It's not terrorism. It's not Islamic terrorism. It's a public health crisis. Our producer, Sam Livingston, put together a quick montage of responses from leaders around the world and what they've been saying about this. And it reveals the fuzzy thinking, the refusal to recognize what is happening here.
We know enough to say that this was an act of terror and an act of hate.
These tragedies are coming to us far too frequently. It is a disease of the soul that goes by different names: hatred, cruelty, intolerance. The cure for it is the medicine of love, kindness, and compassion.
This is a hate crime, plain and simple.
Mentally, he was mentally unstable and mentally ill. That's the only explanation that I could give, and he was obviously disturbed.
It certainly appears to be motivated by a hatred of the freedoms, the free society in which all of us enjoy.
What is clear is that he was a person filled with hatred.
You heard obviously from the president there, and then people like Malcolm Turnbull, the Australian Prime Minister, the terrorist's former wife, the National Executive Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations. And he was mentally ill, that's their only explanation. Or motivated by hate. Now, that is true, he was motivated by hate. But if you want to solve this problem, you have to get much, much more specific. Our hatred is so broad. I hate Brussels sprouts. I'm not going to kill anyone because of that. This was an Islamist attack. And as that former CIA director said, you can't effectively fight something if you can't discuss it. And if we just generalize this away as, well, it was just hate, we're never going to be able to solve that problem. Now, related to the subject of refusing to face up to what actually happened is the division that you see now in America after these attacks. The Washington Post had an article they published on their website yesterday evening called "The New Norm: When Tragedy Hits, Americans Stand Divided." And in that article, they wrote, "Not since 9/11 has a movement like this brought the nation together." And that evaporated quickly. Since then, calamity seems only to drive the left and the right further apart, while faith in the nation's institutions deteriorates further. And the author of this article, she's right. After 9/11, there was a sense of unity for a time. Even over here in Britain, I was living in Britain as I am now back then, and there was very much a feeling of, even we stand united with America. And as this Washington Post article said, it did evaporate quickly, but it was there. Now, though, we have the deadliest terrorist attack on American soil since 9/11, and there's just division. This article goes on to write, across the ideological and partisan divide, it no longer seems possible to even explore, much less agree upon, causes and solutions. So the response has been muddled, even while the next tragedy looms. And that's exactly right. The National Review, they had an article that made a similar case called Orlando Aftermath, To Fight the Enemy, Focus on the Enemy, by David French. And he writes, Twitter is on fire right now with some of the worst vitriol I've ever read. And incredibly, most of it is not directed at the terrorist who killed Americans or the terrorist army that claims credit. Instead, my feed is filled with people on the left utterly furious at the NRA, the National Rifle Association or National Rifleman Association, and a few who are actually tweeting against Christians for wanting to protect their own religious liberty. They're acting as if a Christian baker opened fire in Orlando. Here's the bottom line, David French writes in this article. If you're sitting here this afternoon more angry at your domestic political opponents than you are at the man who killed 50 people or the motivation he reportedly pledged allegiance to, then you need to take serious stock of your moral priorities. To fight the enemy, we have to focus on the enemy. And he's right. But there's far too many Americans who are more worried about fighting other Americans. Going back to the Washington Post article that we quoted, that article quotes an ESPN commentator, Jamili Hill, who said in an interview, "We want to get on the moral high ground when it comes to policing homophobia and other religions. We're not the ones to be engaging in this, as if we have always been supportive of these issues. History says just the opposite." And then after reading that article, I had a look at her Twitter feed, and she wrote on Twitter, "So in a country where we've done everything possible to undermine the LGBTQ community, we are suddenly lecturing Islam on homophobia. Oh." So in other words, America can't deal with any potential problem with radical Islam because America has Christians here too. And to her, Christians upholding what the Bible teaches about marriage and the family, and too few are even willing to do that, but the few that are, well, that's the same as a Muslim terrorist going into a homosexual nightclub and killing 50 people. And Salon is my go-to website if I want some absolutely terrible commentary. And sure enough, they had that in the wake of this attack. Salon, they had an article writing, "The common thread here, again and again, is religious fundamentalism, whether you call it Christian or Muslim." Really? That's the common thread in these attacks? The common thread between what happened in Orlando, in Paris, in Brussels, the July 7 bombing in London, 9/11. The common thread's religious fundamentalism of no particular religion, whether you call it Christianity or Muslim. Well, that's what she wrote. And then she goes on to say, "LGBT people have been the favorite punching bag of the Christian right in this country for years. Whenever the Christian right needs to rally the troops, they start running around, hair on fire, screaming about how the queers are out to get your children." Then a bit further, another paragraph or two down in that article, she writes, "Homophobia, misogyny, toxic masculinity, and religious fundamentalism are all tied together in a noxious knot the feminists call patriarchy. And it's a cancer that crosses culture and national and even religious lines." So patriarchy, that's the problem here. Not Islam. It's toxic masculinity. It's men that are behind this. There's a terrorist attack by a radical Muslim on American soil. But you know, the problem is patriarchy. So this is another writer writing as if Christians who uphold what the Bible says, who teach what the Bible says, well, they're the same as a guy that shoots 50 people. Or they're the same as Muslim preachers who say that homosexuals must be killed as a religious duty. And she concludes her piece by writing, "We strive for an end of all religions, teaching that homosexuality is a sin." And then the last sentence of her article, "Only then will people be free to live their lives without fear of bigotry-based violence." So it doesn't matter what the Bible actually says. She writes here, "We must strive to outlaw or strive to end all religions teaching that homosexuality is a sin." And she concludes that that's the only way to stop these kind of attacks. Really? Making it illegal or stopping Christians somehow reading the passages in the Bible that show that homosexuality is a sin, that's going to stop radical Muslims killing people? Now, this was the biggest attack since 9/11. Obviously, there have been other attacks, other shootings that were not carried out by radical Muslims. But the vast majority of these really big, these huge mass casualty terrorist attacks, they are from radical Islam. That is a fact. And America cannot begin to address this problem. As these articles, as the former CIA director was saying, America cannot begin to address this problem without acknowledging that fact. Now, it is an incredibly hard threat to stop. This was one guy with a gun. Or a couple of guns, I think we know now. And now we know a lot about what motivated him. We don't have all the facts about the planning that went into this attack, this support that he may or may not have had. So far, it looks like he was someone who became radical and who was inspired by the Islamic State, but didn't necessarily have a direct connection with them. And then he just bought a gun or had a gun that he already owned and shot people in a nightclub, a lone wolf attacker. And that is hard to stop. And Mr. Obama and a lot of others, they've focused on guns as the solution. Look at Paris, look at Brussels, look at the attack on the Jewish Museum in Brussels in 2014. It's not hard for someone, even in those countries, especially these radical Muslims, if they really want a gun, it's not hard for them to get one. If they're willing to break the law, they can get an assault rifle. We saw that. But as this National Review article that I quoted a bit earlier brings out, you know, there are things that America could do to defend against this. And it goes through in that article some things America could do. But America won't and America can't because they don't clearly see the enemy. There's no unity of purpose. There's no clarity of purpose. America doesn't want to wake up to the threat of radical Islam and prefers to ignore clear facts like the media or these examples in the media that I read out. And it's not just America, the BBC, obviously, that's from Britain. They want to pretend that these facts just don't exist. And that National Review article talks about when you focus on your enemy, on radical Islam, it becomes clear what you can do, what you can't, and what you can't do, what's not going to work to stop these kind of attacks. But if you don't focus on the enemy, then you end up wasting time with all these plans that aren't going to solve anything. And that is America right now. America's not going to solve the problem with radical Islam. The country can't even agree anymore that there is a problem with radical Islam. As we wind this segment up, I'd just like to read one quote from a different National Review article. And this one was called Ex-CIA Director, Obama's Refusal to Cut Radical Islam is Doing, quote, Real Damage. And this article towards the end says, the sad truth is that the French have been far more clear-eyed about the threat facing them than we are, and they are more willing to acknowledge that they need a new strategy. After terrorists struck Paris last year, French Prime Minister Manuel Valls declared, we are at war, not a war against religion, not a war against a civilization, but to defend our values, which are universal. It is a war against terrorism and radical Islamism, against everything that would break our solidarity, our liberty, our fraternity. France launched punishing airstrikes against ISIS. By comparison with the French, the Obama administration looks timid, obsessed with political appearances, and unserious. So Europe is starting to face up to this problem. The French Prime Minister, he wasn't afraid to call it a war against radical Islamism. That should not be controversial, to say that we are in a war with radical Islamism. 5 years ago, 10 years ago in America, that was not controversial. Apparently it is today. So people can already see signs of things changing in Europe, though. Europe, as it said, has a far more clear-eyed response to what is happening here while America is divided, America argues, America just refuses to even look at there being a problem. We'll take a short break now. When we get back, we'll talk about some of the best coverage on Brexit. And then we'll conclude the program by coming back to this question of why won't America wake up to the dangers that face it? What would it take to wake the nation's leaders up? What would it take to wake the individuals in the nation up? So tune in for that here on KPCG after the break.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
We, the people, are being cajoled, frightened, and bullied into surrendering our democracy and freedom. This film is a rallying cry. We must fight for our independence, for the right to determine ourselves, the laws under which we live, and for the freedom to shape our own future.
This is the most important voting decision that any of us is going to make in our lifetime. With general elections, it doesn't really matter who you vote for, Conservative or Labour, because you know that in 4 years' time, you can change your mind. This time, you can't change your mind. This time is for keeps.
In this film, we'll see how the EU works.
It's like heaven for the politician or bureaucrat, because it's power without accountability.
It was devised to make sure that the great mass of the people could not control government ever again.
The EU is turning into a dictatorship, and this is not overstating it.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. What you just heard in the intro to that segment was the intro to Brexit, the movie. We played some quick clips from that during last Thursday's show, and I wanted to return to that subject briefly now. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma, or online at kpcg.fm. If you want to send us any feedback, you can email td@kpcg.fm. And I did get some feedback, actually, on last Thursday's show from my four-year-old daughter. My wife was listening to the program at home on Thursday while doing some things around the house. My four-year-old was around two. And my wife told me that at one point, my four-year-old went into a fit of giggles and said, "Daddy said you can use a T-shirt as a towel." So that's what she learnt from last Thursday's program. So I taught at least one person something. I think in that statement I was trying to fathom how the EU manages to have 400 regulations on something so simple as a towel. As I said, in that program we played some clips from Brexit, the movie. I think that movie does a great job in exposing some of the flaws in the EU, especially the loss of sovereignty, its undemocratic nature. As we heard in that introductory clip at the top of the programme, we heard from quite a few people in that clip, including Melanie Phillips, on how Britain is losing its sovereignty to an undemocratic EU. And you can watch the whole Brexit the movie on YouTube, and based on what I've seen on Twitter, some of our followers and people that watch the program have watched some of that, and it's great. It is a really well done production, and you can tell how much I liked it by how many of their clips that I used. But it does, I think, have one major flaw, and that's when it comes to Britain leaving the EU. It paints a really rosy picture. You know, quit the EU and everything is going to be great. Britain will return to its glory days. We'll go forward now into the sunlit uplands. We'll trade with the world. We'll be able to solve every problem free from Europe. But that's not true. You know, quitting the EU, no matter how much we might want it, will not make Britain great again. Just like electing Donald Trump in America, for example, won't make America great again. This weekend, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard published an excellent article on Brexit, probably the best I've seen. And at the start of that article, he made many of the same points that we just heard from Brexit the movie. And he wrote, "Stripped of distractions, it comes down to an elemental choice, whether to restore the full self-government of this nation or to continue living under a higher supranational regime ruled by a European Council that we do not elect in any meaningful sense, and that the British people can never remove, even when it persists in error." A bit further down, he writes, "We are deciding whether to be guided by a commission which has quasi-executive powers that operates more like the priesthood of the 13th century papacy than a modern civil service, and whether to submit to a European court of justice that claims sweeping supremacy with no right of appeal. He writes a bit further down in that article, the project bleeds the lifeblood of national institutions, but fails to replace them with anything lovable or legitimate at a European level. It draws away charisma and destroys it. This is how democracies die. He goes on to talk about some of the history of the EU and examples of its anti-democratic nature. The EU crossed a fatal line when it smuggled through the Lisbon Treaty by executive cabal after the text had already been rejected by French and Dutch voters in its earlier guise, he writes. It is one thing to advance the project by stealth and the Monnet method. It is another to call a plebiscite and then to override the outcome. And he really sums up a lot of my thinking on Britain and its place in the EU. And as we talked about on Thursday, Britain has given up so much of its sovereignty, trusting to the EU to solve its problems, giving the EU control over a huge amount of everyday life. And to what end? Has it benefited Britain? And even if it has, or had, is giving up all that sovereignty worth it? He also talks about how the EU is taking over other countries, and he writes, has there ever been a proper airing of how the elected leaders of Greece and Italy were forced out of power and replaced by EU technocrats, perhaps not by coup d'etats in a strict sense, but certainly by skullduggery? On what authority did the European Central Bank write secret letters to the leaders of Spain and Italy in 2011, ordering detailed changes to labour and social law and fiscal policy, holding a gun to their head on bond purchases? He's right, the EU is undemocratic and is becoming more undemocratic with the advent of the Eurozone. He addresses those who say the EU will now have to fall apart and to retreat from their efforts to form a superstate, and he writes, yet retreat is not the declared position of the Five Presidents Report, the chief blueprint for where they want the EU project to go. Far from it. So Europe's leaders still want to push forward to a superstate. And he talks about how the EU is designed to make it all but impossible to retreat from the Union. But here's what he gets to what he gets right and what so many on the Brexit side of the debate get wrong. He writes, let there be no illusion about the trauma of Brexit. Anybody who claims that Britain can lightly disengage after 43 years enmeshed in EU affairs is a charlatan or a dreamer or has little contact with the realities of global finance and geopolitics. So the EU has hurt Britain. Britain has given up sovereignty. As a Brit, I'd love to see my country take back control, govern itself. But as Ambrose Evans-Pritchard points out, it probably will hurt, and there is also just huge danger there. He writes, if we opt to leave, let us not delude ourselves. Personally, I think the economics of Brexit are neutral, this is Ambrose Evans-Pritchard writing, and possibly a net plus over 20 years if executed with skill. But it is nothing more than an anthropological guess. And then he writes, we are compelled to make our choice at a treacherous moment. When our current account deficit has reached 7% of GDP, the worst in peacetime since records began in 1772 under George III. And to kind of translate that to everyday English, Britain is heavily dependent on imports. The country is importing far, far more than it exports. And the UK's reliance on imports it's at its greatest level ever since records began. And that poses a huge danger. If Britain does leave the EU, there's the potential for all of these other nations that Britain imports these vast amounts from could really harm Britain. If Britain does leave, as Ambrose Evans-Pritchard talks about, there's the potential that the pound could dramatically lose value. Then all of those imports that Britain relies upon so heavily will become really expensive. The price of all those goods from overseas would shoot up. It would make it hard for businesses to operate, make it expensive for consumers. It could cause a currency crisis. And Ambrose Evans-Pritchard writes, I am willing to take the calculated risk that our floating currency would act as a benign shock absorber, as devaluation did in 1931, 1992, and 2008. but it could be a very rough ride. And he goes on to talk about the huge amount of debt Britain has, about the debt that British businesses, consumers have. And does this high level of debt, does it matter, he asks? We may find out. He's not sure. He also talks about the potential of Brexit to reignite the conflict in Northern Ireland. And then he makes another point. He also writes, however unfair it may seem, the whole Western world deems Brexit to be an act of strategic vandalism at a time when Pax Americana is cracking and the liberal democracies are under civilizational threat. He then talks about all of the problems around the world, the rise of radical Islam, especially the problems in the Middle East, in North Africa. Vladimir Putin's Russia has ripped up the post-war rulebook and is testing NATO every day in the Balkans, he writes. He talks about China threatening those international shipping routes off the Philippines. And he writes, he says that is leading to a superpower showdown with the US. And he writes, you do not unpick the web of interlocking global ties likely. So there are dangers. The EU itself could push back and they could go out of their way to hurt Britain. That would hurt them too. But they want to prevent other nations from leaving the EU. And some leaders are talking of a punishment beating. And that's a subject Mr. Brad McDonald talked about on this programme some weeks back. And even the US, even America, could resent Britain's decision if we do vote for Brexit. And then the EU, or at least some EU countries, will push towards a superstate, no matter what happened, just like we talked about on Thursday's programme. So much as I do like a lot of what that Brexit the movie video showed, there is real risk here. That June 23rd referendum, it could be a big turning point for Europe and for Britain. And it's probably going to be a big turning point for Europe and for Britain, whatever the outcome. And we talked about that interview from Guy Verhofstadt, who made the point on Thursday's programme, who made the point that if Britain votes to leave, well, the EU will be without Britain, they'll be able to move on and become a proper union. And then he said Britain has also, as part of their renegotiation, secured a whole bunch of opt-outs. So once this is all sorted and Britain votes to stay, then the EU can still move forward to becoming this much more closely integrated union, no matter what happens. And then we've also talked about, especially on Trumpet Hour, just how there have been all of these discussions about a European army that Europe really wants to get on with. They're urgent about this. They see the threat of radical Islam. And they want a common military force to start to deal with that. And they've postponed all of these decisions, all of these discussions until after the Brexit referendum. So whatever happens, whichever way Britain votes June 23rd, it's likely to be a major turning point for the European Union and possibly for Britain. And then as this Ambrose Evans-Pritchard piece points out, Britain does have huge debt. The economy is not stable. The economy is not in a good position if it comes to weathering some kind of storm or any kind of pressure after leaving the European Union. So I thought he had a very complete, very full, very sobering look at Brexit. Now we'll take another short break now. When we come back, we'll return to the subject that we started with, those terrorist attacks in America, and we'll ask, what will it take to wake America up?
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Jesus Christ's New Testament Church began just weeks after his crucifixion. It set to work spreading Christ's gospel message, commanding repentance and preparing for the coming kingdom of God. But immediately the gates of hell rose against it. Satan-inspired individuals, groups, and governments attempted to silence the message. When that failed, the devil forged a counterfeit, a false church that claimed Jesus' name, but mixed the truth with paganism and lawlessness to lead believers astray. Even more deceitfully, he infiltrated the true church with false ministers to dismantle it from the inside. To understand more about this long-forgotten truth, request The True History of God's True Church.
To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily Radio Show here at KPCG, 101.3 on the FM dial, online at kpcg.fm, on SoundCloud, on Apple Podcasts, and on TuneIn Radio, and probably a lot of other different ways. We started today's program talking about the shocking terrorist attack on a homosexual nightclub in Orlando, Florida, and we've looked so far at just how far so many are going in refusing to see any connection between this and radical Islam. You know, people saying hatred is the general cause, blaming the patriarchy, and we see this attack after attack, and if anything, it's getting worse. Attack after attack, people refusing to look at the problem. And you look at this, you read those stories, and you think, well, what would it take to wake these people up? How can they still be asleep to the danger here? And it's not just being asleep. There's, I think, a willful refusal to see what's happening. They don't want to see what's happening. But for many, they are still asleep. And even these terrorist attacks do not wake them up. And it's not just radical terror. As we quoted during the second segment, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard wrote that Pax Americana is cracking and the liberal democracies are under civilizational threat. But what do America's leaders say? Well, here's what Mr. Obama said.
We are fortunate to be living in the most peaceful, most prosperous, most progressive era in human history.
And then John Kerry, he's the U.S. Secretary of State. He says everything's fine. A couple of years ago, someone asked him if America was retreating. And here's a few clips on how he answered that question.
We're not withdrawing from anything, folks. I can't think of a place in the world that we are retreating. Not one. And I believe we are engaged in a profoundly proactive and visionary way to try to give life to this partnership in ways that make a difference. So I think this narrative, which has frankly been pushed by some people who have an interest in trying to suggest that the United States is somehow on a different track, I would tell you it is flat wrong, and it is belied by every single fact of what we were doing everywhere in the world.
So there's all these articles you see weekly, perhaps even almost daily, talking about the end of Pax Americana, the changing world order, the retreat of America, and the person in charge of Americans' foreign relations can't think of a single example where America is retreating, and says that all of that commentary is contradicted by every single fact in every part of the world. And you read things like that and you think, well, what will it take to wake someone like that up? And there's an important lesson for all of us in the answer to that question. I took that as a huge lesson on this subject from a book I read last summer. It's Andrew Roberts' book, The Storm of War, and that's his history of World War II. And in that book, he talks about one incident that really reveals a lot about human nature, that reveals a lot about how hard it is to wake up a nation after they've gone to sleep. And in January 10th, 1940, a German plane got lost in the fog and landed in Belgium. At this point, World War II had started. Germany had invaded Poland. But Belgium was not at war with Germany. They were neutral. They had not been invaded. But in this plane that got lost in the fog and landed in Belgium, in this plane were detailed plans for a German invasion of Belgium. The courier in this plane, he tried desperately to destroy these plans, and he failed. The Belgians, they captured these plans that detailed Germany's invasion plan for their country. Not only that, then they secretly recorded the courier meeting with the German air attaché, and the conversation that these men had confirmed that these plans were genuine. So Belgium had concrete proof, black and white, on paper, that Germany was planning to invade them. And what did they do? Almost nothing. Now, fast forward a few months. By May 1940, Germany had taken over Austria, it had invaded Czechoslovakia, Poland had been split between the Nazis and the Soviet Union, Denmark had been conquered, so had Norway. So Germany had invaded almost all of its neighbours. The Belgians, as I said, they'd captured invasion plans from Germany. Yet when that invasion came, when Germany invaded Belgium on May 10th, 1940, it was a complete surprise. They'd had these plans for months. They'd watched Germany invade country after country for years. Yet the nation was still asleep. The warning guns in one of the most important Belgian forts was out of action. The country had roadblocks that were still in place on the border with France. And this meant that British and French troops couldn't come to Belgium's aid until the roadblocks had all been demolished. And that was a costly time delay at a time where time was critical. The Belgian railway, it was not ready, not at all prepared to bring British and French troops and British and French equipment to the rescue. They had no trains to bring French equipment across the border. The day before the invasion, the Belgian army had increased the amount of time off its soldiers got from 2 days a month to 5 days a month. So they were even, in that sense, drawing down their troops. And so they were caught completely by surprise. Many of its aeroplanes were destroyed in the hangars. They had all of this warning, all of these events that screamed, "Wake up!" And the nation was still asleep. Andrew Roberts in The Storm of War, he writes, "Considering that the Allies had been at war with Nazi Germany for over 8 months, it is astonishing that the Wehrmacht achieved such surprise as it unleashed Blitzkrieg on the West, especially as only 1 month earlier, it had equally suddenly invaded Denmark and Norway." And that, to me, is one of the key lessons from World War II, how hard it is to wake a nation up once it's asleep. And to me, this history is astonishing. Belgium is maybe one of the worst examples, not the only one. Stalin was completely surprised by Operation Barbarossa, the German invasion of Russia, despite the fact that this was one of the largest invasions in the history of the world. And he, too, had warning after warning after warning. But no, he decided he absolutely trusted Hitler. That couldn't wake him up out of that complacency. And even Britain and America, you know, we saw this in the whole lead-up of the war. Hitler wrote a book saying what he planned to do, and yet people were surprised every time he invaded a country. And then even war broke out, and for 8 months, Britain and France pretty much sat there and did nothing. And that's why it's so terrible for a nation to go to sleep. Your enemy can basically send you a letter saying, "We're going to attack you and here are our plans," and you still don't wake up. And this applies to individuals too. In law enforcement and military training, they talk about something called Cooper's color system. And it's about how aware you personally or individually are about the nation, about your situation. And Stratfor has written a lot about this too. And they've kind of given a few labels to that system to kind of make it more accessible. And the lowest level on this system of situational awareness is called tuned out. And it's basically being asleep. And they write that this is similar to when a person is driving in a very familiar environment or engrossed in thought, a daydream, a song on the radio, or even the kids fighting in the back seat. Increasingly, cell phone calls and texting are causing people to tune out while they drive. A person experiences tuned out driving when they arrive somewhere without really thinking about their trip. So in other words, they're asleep. They're going around their lives. They're not really paying attention. And in the Stratfor, when they're writing on this, they go through the other levels of awareness, kind of like relaxed awareness, where you're still driving, but focused on what you're doing. And then higher levels of awareness as potential hazards come up. And in this article, they warn about the dangers of sleep, the dangers of being tuned out. And they write that if one is tuned out while driving and something unexpected happens, say a child runs into the road or a car ahead stops quickly, one will not see the problem coming. This usually means one either does not see the hazard in time and hits it, or they totally panic, freeze, and cannot react to it. Neither is good. And they talk about when many, many people are forced to make this mental jump, they panic and stall, going into shock and actually freezing up, rendering them unable to take any action. They go comatose. This happens not only when driving, but also when a criminal catches someone totally unaware and unprepared. And then they write, it is difficult even for highly trained individuals to transition from the tuned out or the sleep to high alert stages. This is why law enforcement and military personnel receive so much training on situational awareness. So in other words, it's the same thing that we saw in Belgium, just on a personal level. If you're asleep, if you're tuned out, it's very hard to wake up. If something happens that really should shake you, that should wake you up, you either don't notice or just completely freeze and can't react. Another Stratfor piece they had some years ago described the kidnapping of an American executive in Manila. A group called the Red Scorpion Group kidnapped him. And what happened is they tried to box in his car and they made one attempt at kidnapping him. His driver managed to get away, but the executive, he was asleep. Not literally, but he was tuned out. He was metaphorically asleep. He didn't notice the kidnap attempt because of this. And so he made no changes. And the kidnappers tried again the next day, exactly the same place, exactly the same time, same people, and this time they succeeded. So if you're tuned out, if you're asleep, someone could try and kidnap you and you'd not notice. And the people that debriefed this kidnap victim, they were just astonished that he could have gone through the attempted kidnap, not notice, and then the kidnappers just do exactly the same thing the next day. So it applies on an individual level. It applies on a national level. You know, as I said, you can capture the invasion plans for your country from the enemy and still not wake up. That's why Iran can work towards an atomic bomb, get caught working towards an atomic bomb, say that they want to wipe Israel off the map, and still people not wake up. That's why Muslims can carry out, or radical Muslim can carry out a massive terrorist attack on the US, and then people still talk about the patriarchy being responsible. As I said, there's more to it there than simple sleep, but that is a part of it for a lot of people. And it applies on a national, on an individual level. In 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 6 to 8, God tells us, therefore, let us not sleep as do others, but let us watch and be sober. For they that sleep, sleep in the night, and they that be drunken are drunken in the night. But let us who are of the day be sober. So we must watch. We must be sober, because if we go to sleep, if a nation goes to sleep, but even if each of us individually, if we go to sleep in our news watching, in watching Bible prophecy be fulfilled, you know, there could be these huge earth-shaking events. But it is far harder to wake someone up once they're asleep than we might think. These huge events could well not shake us. We don't keep sleeping. And that's why there are so many warnings in the Bible like this against falling asleep. So much of America, so much of Britain, so many of our leaders, they're asleep. But each of us individually, we need to be awake to what is happening. We must be watching, as this scripture brings out, watching world news. And that's what we try to help you do on this show. That's what we're going to keep doing this week and keep doing on this show. So stay tuned in. And to our other programming on KPCG. That's about it from me today. I think Mr. Stephen Flurry will be back tomorrow. I'm not certain on that. I'm sure he'll have plenty more to say about the attacks in Florida as the week goes on and all the other news that we're surrounded with. So tune in at the same time tomorrow for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show here on 101.3 on the FM dial and at kpcg.fm.